The Triathlon Show 258. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Professor Grégoire Millet. Professor Millet is one of the world's foremost researchers in the field of altitude training and hypoxic training in general, and not only is he a great researcher, but he has a background himself as an elite triathlete and a coach, so he's not just somebody who knows everything about the science, but actually how to apply these things in the real world as well. So in this episode, we will go into many, many details, both the physiological, but also the practical and training structure-wise about altitude training, how to get the most out of altitude training camps, why everybody can benefit from them. There really is no such thing as non-responders. But we also talk a little bit towards the end about a few of the world's best athletes that Professor Millet has worked with and published data from, including Martin Fourcade, who is the most successful biathlete of the last decade and the most successful French Olympian of all time, and Kilian Jornet, who I'm sure most of you know who is, a mountaineer, trail and mountain runner, and summited Mount Everest twice in a week without supplemental oxygen in super fast times for that ascent. So it's an exciting interview we have coming up. We'll get right into it after thanking our sponsors, Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. And they have developed an online sweat test that you can use to get a good ballpark estimate for how much sodium you lose in your sweat. And with that information, you also get a really good starting point for a race hydration plan that you can use right out. And then, of course, as time goes by and you do more races, you can do some fine-tuning to it. But it's really amazing how far you can get with just that online sweat test and the 10 simple questions in that you will answer about how you typically sweat during training. So go and take that test. And then if you want to try Precision Hydration's electrolyte products that you can match to your sweat sodium concentration, then you can get 15% off your order with the promo code DETTRIATHLONSHOW15 on precisionhydration.com. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Roka are the world-leading manufacturers of wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses. And they are trusted by some of the world's best athletes, including triathletes such as Lucy Charles Barclay, Flora Duffy, Katie Zafiris, Javier Gomez, Mario Mola, and many, many others. You can get 20% off your order with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. One thing that I should mention before we get into the interview is that my microphone didn't play nice with me for when we were conducting this interview. It actually chose not to connect, and in the end it turned out that it was a USB port that wasn't working properly. So it's fixed now that I'm recording this intro and outro. But for the interview itself, I'm using the built-in computer microphone, which isn't great sound quality. Grégoire has a better sound quality on his end with his computer. But anyway, apologies for that. It should only be this interview, because I managed to solve the issue very soon after conducting this interview. But again, apologies for the less than ideal sound quality on my end. Now, let's jump into that interview with Professor Grégoire Millet. Welcome, Grégoire, to that triathlon show. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. Yeah, I'm very pleased to speak with you.
It's great to have you. You're somebody who has published a lot of research relevant to endurance athletes through the years. And whenever you read books like, for example, books that cite a lot of science, and you go to the references, it's amazing how often your name pops up there. So it's really great to have you on. And let's start with the main topic for today, which is altitude training, which you have done a lot of research in. Can you start by just describing physiologically what happens when we are training and racing
at altitude compared to what it's like at sea level, or
Yeah, historically, altitude training was only spending 3 or 4 weeks in the real mountain. You know, like it started before the Mexico Olympic Games in 1968. So this method where you live and train high is called live high, train high. So we will first discuss, I guess, this way of using altitude training. And then the main goal, the main outcome is to improve the oxygen transport capacity. This oxygen transport capacity comes from the improvement in the convective factor, the way hemoglobin will transport the oxygen from the lung to the muscle, to the mitochondria. And one of the most important parameter then is the increase in the total hemoglobin mass. And we will discuss that a bit because hemoglobin mass, you can get it from like a classic blood sample. And most of the time, you will only have the hemoglobin concentration, while it is much better to measure the total hemoglobin mass in the body. So how does it work? How can we really increase the total hemoglobin mass? It starts from the respiratory function. When you will travel to the mountain, the barometric pressure is reduced. Even at the top of Mount Everest, you will have 20.93% of oxygen in the air. So it's not the point to have less oxygen. It is the point is that it is more difficult to use it. And it is more difficult to use it because due to the decreased barometric pressure, the oxygen pressure in the ambient air is reduced. Then the oxygen pressure in the alveolar, in the blood, and at all the different step of the oxygen cascade will be reduced. And what happens when you go to the mountain is you will try to reduce the decrease due to the lower oxygen pressure in the air. And how do you do that? You will start to overbreathe. And since you overbreathe, first, it is a good sign. It shows that you are able to detect that you are in an hypoxic environment. Secondly, it will have a lot of consequences. If I can try to explain briefly what happened, when I will overbreathe, my breathing frequency, my respiratory rate will increase, and it will induce a lot of CO2 release. I will exhale a lot of CO2. I will overbreathe because it's a way to mechanically increase the pressure in my alveolar, like if you pump in a balloon, you know, you will pump in a balloon, so the pressure in the balloon will increase. If I overbreathe, it will increase the pressure in the alveolar. That will make potentially the diffusion of the oxygen from the alveolar to the capillary a bit easier. But since I overbreathe, I will exhale a lot of CO2. That will induce what we call the hypocapnia, a reduction in the CO2 concentration in the blood. So the acid-base balance in the blood will change. And then later on, after a few days, it will make the blood concentration, the blood composition a bit different. And one of the most important things is that this hypocapnia will change the cerebral blood flow, the cerebral perfusion. So that explains partly that altitude is not a reduction in oxygen in the body. It's also due to this hyperventilation mechanism. It's also a reduction in the CO2 in the body. So you have hypocapnia, and at the blood level, we are talking about hypoxemia. And we have hypoxia, and at the blood level it's hypoxemia, and you have hypocapnia. So let's talk about the effect of this hypocapnia.
To make one note here quickly for the listeners that may not be aware, the alveoli that you're referring to, that's where the diffusion of oxygen between the lungs and the capillaries occur. So they're part of the lungs, essentially.
Exactly. So just to give you a number, at sea level in Normoxia, the ambient air PO2 is about 150 millimeters of mercury. And then at the arterial level, the PaO2, the arterial pressure of oxygen, is 100. So if you go to the Mount Everest, in the ambient air, it will be something like a third. Instead of having 150, you will have something like 50 millimeters of mercury. And then you can easily understand that it will be much more difficult for this pressure of oxygen to have the diffusion and to get this oxygen in the blood. And the oxygen is transported, binded to the hemoglobin. But I would like also to explain that if you have this hypocapnia, the acid-base balance will change. That means you will need less bicarbonate in your blood. And then you will decrease the bicarbonate by what we call the diuresis, an increase in the urine release. I'm not 100% sure it's exactly the right term, but diuresis, it means you will in some way pee much more. So for the coaches, it's quite interesting to see that he has already few way to observe if an athlete has a good chemosensitivity, a good way for his body to detect hypoxia or not. One first expected response is overbreathing, hyperventilation. Another way he could observe is his athlete has a good chemosensitivity is by their need of going much more often during the first week to the toilet for due to the need to pee. Secondly, so you will have a decrease in the arterial pressure in oxygen, and this arterial pressure of oxygen then will make the aerobic performance much less effective. It is of interest to observe that at every stage of the oxygen cascade, then you have some adaptive responses, adaptive mechanisms. And for that, what we call acclimatization. The acclimatization process really is required if you want to minimize the detrimental effect of altitude and if you want to optimize the benefits that you expect post-altitude training camp.
So can you explain the performance decrease in terms of the arterial pressure of oxygen a bit more? Is it simply a factor of or for the reason that that it's more difficult for the oxygen to diffuse across the alveoli to the hemoglobin in the red blood cells, or are there some other factors going on there as well?
The main factor is this decreased convection. That means you have less oxygen that will diffuse to the capillary that is perfusing the alveoli. Then instead of having 100 millimeters of mercury, that is the, let's say, normal way in normoxia, you will have a lower value. That's what we call hypoxemia. So instead of having 100 at the lung level, if you are about 2,500 meters of altitude, you will have something like 60 millimeters of mercury as arterial pressure. And the lowest value ever measured has been measured by one British team at the just below the top of Mount Everest. It was something like 20 millimeters of mercury as arterial pressure in oxygen. So you can imagine how difficult it is then to do any movement. So what is important is to understand also that oxygen is mainly transported by the blood when bind to hemoglobin. It is a form of hemoglobin that we call oxyhemoglobin, O2HB. And this oxyhemoglobin is a very important factor to check. So it is high in the lung and it will be less in the muscle because oxygen then will diffuse. The second diffusive factor will diffuse from the capillary in the muscles to the mitochondria. And mitochondria, as you might know, is somewhere a small factory that will use oxygen and substrate, for example, glucose, to give to the muscle this currency that we call ATP. So mitochondria has to be seen as a way to transform some chemical energy, oxygen, lipid, glucose, and so on, to something that will be used by the muscle to produce mechanical energy. And as you might know, the ratio mechanical energy over chemical energy is called efficiency. And what we know is that altitude does not modify efficiency in human muscle. So that means the decrease in aerobic performance is strongly related to the decrease in VO2 max, and the decrease in VO2 max is strongly related to the hemoglobin concentration. So it's a very important parameter.
Yes. And how does it then adapt to altitude training? So if you talk about what are the changes that we then see when we have adapted to altitude and maybe go down to sea level to race, what's the difference then?
So the best way to check if an altitude training camp has been effective is by measuring the total hemoglobin mass. So it is by using some technique that have been developed by one German colleague, Walter Schmidt. And this method is called optimized CO rebriefing technique. So you will, from that, not measure only the hemoglobin concentration, but the total mass of hemoglobin in the body. Let's say for somebody who is healthy, but not so much trained, his VO2 max for a male will be between 40 and 45. Right? His total hemoglobin mass for somebody who is about 70 kilo will be between 700 to 800 gram. Now, let's speak about a top endurance athlete. The highest value comes from Kilian Jornet, 92, just after my Norwegian colleague published another value with a Norwegian cyclist who has been a junior world champion. He was 95, if I remember well. So 92 is about twice the value of a healthy adult. And then the total hemoglobin mass in these champions is about twice the value of what is seen in healthy adults. That instead of having 700 to 800 gram of hemoglobin, these guys, they might have up to 1.5 kilo, 1.6 kilo in their body. And then coming back to the effectiveness of altitude training, one of the best way is to measure this total hemoglobin mass. And then we do expect about 100% increase in your total hemoglobin mass for every 100 hour spent in altitude. 100 hour of exposure at altitude is likely to lead to 1% increase in hemoglobin mass. If everything is done correctly, if the altitude is also optimal.
Can
and then, sorry.
Sorry, go on. I think you were just going on to it. So can you describe what is optimal altitude, and then also what are the typical magnitudes that you can see if everything is done right? How many percentage in total would you expect to see until you can't get any better effects, really?
So we are still talking about the living high, training high methods. So if you spend about 3 weeks, you can expect in including in very top athletes up to 3 to 4% increase in your total hemoglobin mass. And for that, it has to be at the optimal altitude. We do recommend that they sleep and train around 2,300, 2,500. One of the issue if you sleep too high is that the quality of your sleep is really decreased. You know, you have a periodic breathing, you have hypopnea, apnea, and then you will desaturate during the sleep. That means the recovery will be affected, and the outcome post-altitude training camp is likely then to be damaged. If you sleep at 2,500, then you are exactly at the right altitude based on this oxyhemoglobin curve that I did explain before, and you are likely to be slightly below 60 millimeter of mercury in arterial pressure of oxygen. And then it is also an altitude where the quality of the training can be maintained. So if I do summarize, you do expect to have at least 2% of total hemoglobin mass increase. That is to spend the minimum 18 days, but optimally 3 to 4 weeks. And you have to stay, you sleep and you train between 2003 up to 2005. The athletes who are very, very experienced and acclimatized, or the athletes who comes from like a mountain region, who have their ancestry, you say that? Ancestry also, so they are very well adapted for genetic reason, then you can expect them also to be effective a slightly higher altitude. But we don't recommend for any athletes to train and to sleep above 3,000 meters.
Mm. And how does the 2 or 3% increase in total hemoglobin mass relate to potential performance improvement? You mentioned that is it almost linear to VO2 max improvement, so you can expect also a 2 to 3% improvement in VO2 max, and then performance might potentially be similar or maybe a bit less. Do you have any data on how hemoglobin relates to performance?
It's a very good question. So as you know, endurance performance is not only induced by VO2 max. You have three main parameters. The first one is VO2 max, that is improved post-altitude due to this increase in total hemoglobin mass. We have also to make sure that altitude is not detrimental for the second factor, that is economy or efficiency. Economy is one of the most important factor in distance running, and that's the reason why the East African athletes are so successful in long distance running, because they are likely to be more economical. I mean by that the energy per kilo of body mass divided by unit of distance is lower. They are more economical. They will use less fuel per unit of distance. And altitude, one of the good points is that, again, if you do everything right, altitude is likely to improve a VO2 max, but also to improve economy. Improving economy means reducing the running energy cost. You know, the running energy cost, you express running energy cost in joule per kilo per meter, but very often we use milliliter of oxygen per kilo of body mass per kilometer. And somebody like let's say Paula Radcliffe, she had a value about 170, and the best human ever measured are from Eritrea or from Ethiopia, and the men, they can have a value lower than 160 milliliters of oxygen per kilo per kilometer. That is extremely low value for running energy cost, very good economy. So altitude, if altitude was supposed to improve VO2 max, but at the same rate would be detrimental to economy, there would be no benefits to go to altitude. You would improve your VO2 max. It's more or less to the same percent that your increase in hemoglobin mass, right? But if the running economy is damaged, then you would not benefit from your VO2 max improvement. You would have no translation in terms of velocity. By chance, if you do everything right, you can improve VO2 max and also improve economy.
So that is very interesting.
One of the things I would like to mention is that altitude is something quite difficult to handle for the coaches. They have to make sure the athletes will train at the right velocity, at the right intensity. If you don't have experience with previous altitude training camp, you can use a very simple matrix that most of the athletes, they will decrease at altitude, they will decrease VO2 max from 6 to 7% for every 1,000 meter. That means if you are at 2,000, it will be something like 15% decreased in VO2 max. That has to translate to a lower running velocity or power output in cycling. If you train too intense, too fast during the altitude training camp, and especially during the acclimatization phase, then it is very likely that the benefits in terms of your increased hemoglobin mass and improved VO2 max post-altitude will be much lower.
So let's talk a bit about the training to do when at altitude. And so you said that ideally, well, you want at least 18 days, but ideally 3 to 4 weeks. So how long should the quote-unquote adaptation period be, and what type of training should you be doing then, and at what point might you start to do a bit more intense training, if any? What's your general recommendations, both from a scientific but also maybe from a just practical coaching perspective?
Yeah, it is a very important question. For me, it's probably the key question. You need to maintain aerobic training during the whole acclimatization phase. So the acclimatization phase can be only a few days for the athletes who are going very regularly to altitude, but it can be up to 8 to 10 days in the athletes less experienced or who are responding less easily to altitude. And so at least for 5 days, but sometimes up to 10 days, you have to prescribe only low intensity training plus strength plus sprint. So strength and sprint is to maintain the neuromuscular quality, the explosivity, you know, to maintain the capacity to accelerate on a very short period of time. But all the long training has to be well managed, well controlled, to make sure that the athletes stay only in the moderate intensity domain. And the moderate intensity domain is below the first threshold, lactic threshold or ventilatory threshold. It is very, very important. Keep in mind that the hemoglobin mass increase starts from this ventilatory adaptation that I did describe, this hyperventilation mechanisms. But the erythropoietic responses, the production by the kidney of erythropoietin that leads to production of erythrocyte and then to increase in hemoglobin mass in red cell volume. This erythropoietic adaptation or response can be blunt if the training is too intense. Acidosis is likely to blunt the erythropoietic responses at altitude. So during the acclimatization phase, you know, during this period, for some athletes, 5 days, for some up to 10 days, you have to make sure that the respiratory acclimatization is going well, is developing, and that the erythropoietic responses is effective. And then later on, week 2, week 3, week 4, progressively, you can start to do more intense training like fartlek, interval training, repeated spring training, whatever. But it's very, very important that, again, you know, that's my main recommendation during the altitude training camp, to make sure the training intensity is well controlled and well understood by the athletes. It is something that is not new. Huh? I did one of my students, Raphael, found some TV program of 1966 on the Swiss TV. And already in 1966, the medical doctor of the National Training Center in Switzerland was explaining that it's very difficult for the athletes to understand that they have to train at a lower velocity, at a lower intensity because of the altitude.
Yeah. And when you have, is there a way to know when your acclimatization period is good enough? Or can you do some sort of measurements to determine that, okay, now you can start to introduce a little bit of intensity in your training?
Yeah, it's a very, very important question. Thank you for that. Obviously, the best way to check the end of the acclimatization period is to monitor the blood gases and to monitor the saturation. You can use oximeter. You know, it's a small piece of equipment that you can have at the finger or at the earlobe, and it will give you a number. At sea level, it's 98%. What does it mean, 98%? That means 98% of the oxygen transported in the blood compartment is bound on hemoglobin. Only 2% is transported in another way. And 98%, the saturation, then obviously the value will decrease. And during the first week, you expect, for example, the sleeping saturation value to progressively increase day after day. So we have experience where if you go, for example, to 2,500, instead of sleeping at 98% of saturation, you might have some athletes, they will desaturate down to 88, 87. And then you expect every day that progressively they increase their saturation. If from day 1 to day 2, they move up from 87 to 88, okay, that's fine. If you start too intense training too early, it's likely that the following night, saturation will decrease again. So saturation is probably the easiest and most interesting parameter to be measured in altitude. You need to check that the acclimatization process is really effective, is really occurring, by looking for a progressive increase in this saturation. And then, obviously, you will never reach again the 98% value that you will find at sea level. After a few days, maybe the athletes will start to stabilize at 93, 94, and then it is the first indication that probably you can start some more intense training. The second point, very important to be monitored, is the hydration level. Remember, I did explain that the hyper ventilation process was leading to a diuresis crisis. The fact that you are peeing urine, you have the urine release much higher. It's a good sign of adaptation, but then it is inducing that the risk of dehydration is higher. And keep in mind also that since you will hyperventilate, you will release a lot of water by the breathing with water vapor. So you are losing water by two-way to a much higher rate than at sea level. So you have to check the hydration. In our studies and in training camp, you have different ways. It can be urine specific gravity to use a refractometer, and then you check the urine gravity. It can be by using like a bioimpedance system that will give to you the value in intracellular, extracellular water. It can be simply by weighting the athletes every morning to make sure that they don't have a large drop from day one to day two. It can be by using some like color strip, whatever. It is more or less sophisticated, but definitely my second advice is check the hydration of your athletes at least and daily, very accurately during this acclimatization phase. It is important that they don't get dehydrated. If not, again, the acclimatization process can be blunted. The third way we use during altitude training is to use heart rate variability. So you can have the athletes to perform a small test in the morning, supine and standing. And from that, you will check the acclimatization by looking to the sympathetic versus parasympathetic balance of the autonomous nervous system responses. You know, and this... it's a bit complicated to explain like that during a podcast, but we have some good way to assess the sympathetic parasympathetic balance, and you can see if something gets wrong, then you can adapt the altitude. If you sleep in an hypoxic chamber, it's easier, but then you can reduce the altitude. If you are in a real altitude training camp, it's more tricky. That would mean that you change the altitude of your of your location, of your residence, you know, to go a bit lower. So yeah. To summarize in terms of monitoring this acclimatization phase, I would recommend just to use heart rate variability. Any way to accurately measure hydration, and very compulsory to use saturation and obviously heart rate.
Right. And when we have successfully completed an adaptation period and things are looking good with the monitoring, what can the load be in as we resume more normal training? Would you be okay, let's say a triathlete is used to doing 4 or 5 high intensity workouts per week, would they be able to do the same, but just adjust the intensity down, of course, because as you mentioned, 67% a decrease in VO2 max per 1,000 meters of altitude. But with the amount of intensity, is it possible to do the same amount and the same amount of volume and load, or what's your advice around that?
Yeah, volume is not a problem. You can maintain very high volume in altitude as long that you have enough water, you know, enough drink, and you're sure that also you have a higher glucide intake, because altitude is also modifying the oxidation of the different substrate. Less fat, more sugar, more glucose. So you have also to change the nutrition to make sure they have enough glycogen. The risk of hypoglycemia is higher in altitude. But let's say if you do that well, it's not a problem. The athletes train very long, very, very long hours and high volume in altitude. You know, if you want to prepare Hawaii, you need a high volume of training anyway. For the intensity, as I did explain, if you use the 6-7% for every 1,000 meter, it is the acute responses. After the acclimatization, you will bit by bit be able to increase the intensity of training. It will never come back to the sea level value, right? But after 6 to 8 days, it's possible then instead of, let's say, 15% at 2,000 meter of altitude, you can compensate this decrease by 1/3. So it can be, like instead of 15%, it could be, let's say, 9%. Mm. And then from that, you can calculate your pace. And progressively, even at the end of a 3 weeks training camp, it has to be at least lower by 5%.
Yeah.
I am clear? Or?
Yes. Just one follow-up question. Would you recommend, is it possible to do a similar amount of intense training as you do at sea level, even though the intensity is still a little bit lower, but can you do the same amount? So again, if you are used to doing 5 intense sessions for a triathlete, which could be quite normal for an elite triathlete, would you still do 5 intense sessions of a similar type at altitude?
Yeah, I think you have to be very prudent, very cautious that because of the higher rate of glycogen use, it's likely that if you do too often high intensity training, interval training, in swimming, in cycling, in running, it's likely that the muscle recovery will be less or will be lowered compared to sea level. So I would recommend that you have more time between 2 interval training session, and also that during the session you use a little bit longer recovery. The reason to use longer recovery between reps is that the heart rate increase, and especially during recovery, the heart rate decrease and the VO2 decrease, what we call the off VO2 kinetics, is slower in altitude. So if you want to come back to the resting value, it will take you longer in altitude. That's why if you want to do like interval training, we do recommend longer recovery. So yeah, you have to adapt the intensity of your interval training in the work interval, and you have to adapt mainly the length of the recovery interval. So that's why it's, and everything is obviously different from one athlete to the other one. The one who's adapting well, and the one who will need a lower altitude or longer time to acclimatize, then you have to prescribe the interval training session after the acclimatization phase in a different way.
Yeah, that's good advice. So speaking of the individual variation in how you adapt, what is that variation? Can everybody get some positive benefits from altitude training, or are there people that are non-responders? What's your take on that?
Yeah, you know, the concept of responder and non-responder is very tricky. My view is that for anything, you are non-responder to because a stimulus is wrong for you. Let's take an example. If you have a too low level of ferritin, of iron, ceric iron in your blood when you arrive at altitude, whatever you do there, it will not work for you. The erythropoietic responses, the fact that your kidney will produce EPO and then that will lead to the increase in your hemoglobin mass, that requests to have iron in your blood. So people can go to altitude, they can do everything right, but since you forgot to check the iron level, you might guess, oh, he's a bad responder, he's a non-responder to altitude. The next time you check the ferritin, and then for the same type of training, the same organization, it could work for him. The other issue is the question of the altitude severity. If you need a lower altitude because you are already hypoxemic at sea level means that at the end of the VO2 max test, your arterial pressure in oxygen is already severely decreased. You know, it can be down to 70 millimeter of mercury in some athletes at sea level. Or if you check the saturation at the end of a VO2 max test, most of the people will desaturate a little bit from 98 to, let's say, 95, 96 at sea level. But most of the proportion of the endurance, elite endurance athletes will be hypoxemic. They will have a large drop in their saturation, down to 88 some for some of them. So if you are already desaturating a lot at sea level, guess that what will happen at altitude. It's probably that you need a lower altitude that compared to your counterpart colleague who's desaturating less. So we have many parameters to check if we want to be sure that the guy is non-responding to altitude. So to be honest, I don't think that there is really non-responder to altitude. I think simply that either the altitude training camp was not well monitored, well prescribed. Many mistakes have been done. You know, dehydration, iron, nutrition, intensity, recovery, and so on and so on. Or either that the stimulus by itself, the severity of altitude or the length of the exposure was not adapted. It can be too low or it can be too high. It's like a medication, you know. If you have a headache and you need two pills, if I give you half a pill, it will not work. Then altitude is too low. But if I give you 10 pills, it's not satisfying. So you will have a stomach pain and you will probably still have the headache. So how can I translate that in English? Medication, the dose makes the poison, right? Yeah. Altitude exactly the same. The dose makes the poison. Too high is detrimental. Too low is not effective. And it has to be high. You have to check if it's high enough or low enough for any athletes based on his experience, his chemosensitivity, means his body, is it able to detect altitude? You know, that's why I do emphasize the need to observe the behavior of your athletes. One athlete who's not over-breathing, one athlete who's not going to the toilet very often during the first days, it's likely that he didn't start the acclimatization process. So it's likely that post-altitude, he won't get the same benefits than the people who have this high chemosensitivity.
Yeah, that's really good advice. And how long can the adaptations that we get from altitude training last? And also, what does that mean in terms of when should you go back to sea level if you're racing at sea level after an altitude training camp?
Yeah, it's another very tricky point. You know, for long, studies have been conducted only to monitor what's going on during the altitude training camp. Very few studies have been performed post-altitude. So Rob Chapman, who's a colleague working in USA, and he is still, the scientific advisor for USA Track and Field, very knowledgeable about altitude training. He published a few papers about the kinetics of the adaptation post-altitude. So you're likely to have, at least for some of the athletes, a first window of few days post-altitude, where it's possible to get a very good performance. You know, just day two, day three, post-altitude. But often, it's not possible to use this window for logistical reason. You know, if you have to travel, if you have to do heat acclimatization and so on, very difficult. Then it's likely also that you have a period where it is... bad performance may occur. Again, you have some exceptions. Some athletes can have their PB at day 8 or day 10 post-altitude. But for most of us, it's unlikely that you will get a good performance between day 5 and day 12, you know, roughly. And then the most secure period to benefit from the altitude adaptation is after 2 weeks or after 3 weeks. So from day 14 to day 28, then you have like a plateau. During this plateau, so 2 weeks to 3-4 weeks post altitude, you will get the benefits of this hematological adaptation, this HB mass erythropoietic responses. You will still have the adaptation about your respiratory muscle, respiratory mechanics, and it's likely that you will get an improvement in your economy. So you will have improvement during this plateau, post 2 weeks, post 3 weeks, up to post 4 weeks, in your VO2 max and in your economy. That means it's likely that for a distance runner or a triathlete, likely that you will get good performances.
Perfect.
The reason why you have less chance to have good performance, let's say at day 7 to day 5 to day 12, you know, it has been speculated that post-altitude, you need to readapt your breathing, you need to readapt your gait, your running mechanics, and you have to wait a little bit longer to make sure you get the full benefits of the hematological adaptation. So Rob Chapman was talking about hematological hypothesis, biomechanical hypothesis, and ventilatory hypothesis. By chance, this summer, we had the opportunity to test on the instrumented treadmill with force plate, the running mechanics of 10 young Swiss middle distance runners. Just before they went to Saint-Moritz. Saint-Moritz is 1850 meters of altitude. You know, it's a very good spot for altitude training. A lot of distance runners are going there. So we did measure the running mechanics of these athletes immediately before the altitude training camp and immediately after. The idea was to check if, as speculated, as expected, altitude training would be detrimental for your running mechanics. For example, detrimental running mechanics would mean a longer contact time, higher vertical oscillation of your center of mass, lower leg stiffness, you know. We are not talking about metabolic responses. We are talking only about mechanics of running. And the principle that was underlying this hypothesis of a detrimental effect of altitude on the running mechanics is simply that if I spend 3 weeks running in altitude and due to the lower VO2 max, and as I did explain before, the need of a lower running velocity, I might have an effect on the running mechanics. My running mechanics then would need to be retrained, readapt during these 5 to 12 days where the performance likelihood is reduced. So we tested this biomechanical hypothesis, and contradictory to our hypothesis and to the general assumption in the altitude training world, we did not observe any change post 3 weeks of running at altitude. That means, in other words, that it's still very unclear why the likelihood to get good performance between this negative phase, day 5 to day 12, why does it occur, you know? But for sure, it will not occur because altitude training was detrimental to your running biomechanics. Because we did, the paper is... will be released very soon to explain this this point.
Okay, yeah, that's really interesting to hear that there's a new science about that, and also you mentioned at the beginning of this interview about including some sprints in your training just for that neuromuscular and I guess potentially even biomechanical aspects of maintaining some of that.
Another wrong assumption that was also sometimes proposed for altitude training was that altitude training by itself would lead to a reduction in your cross-section area, in your muscle volume or muscle mass. It is true that extremely high dose of altitude, let's say if you spend 100 days at 3,000 meter, or if you spend a month at 6,000 meter, it is true that it might induce some muscle waste, muscle mass loss. Mm. But we are talking about altitude up to 3,000 meter and up to 4 weeks. That means, and some colleague from Belgium had a very good study about that, Louis Deldic. They showed that the hypoxic dose that would lead to this detrimental effect in terms of muscle mass and then consequently in terms of power and explosivity is by far larger than what we do recommend for the athletes. But since you can't do any interval training during the acclimatization phase, then we do recommend that you do some sprint, some strength to maintain the neuromuscular function.
Yeah. And so we have primarily discussed living high and training high, but what about living high and training low? Can you talk about the difference of that protocol?
Yeah, living high, training low is a very good example of scientists coming on board with some idea. And I'm talking Professor Benjamin Levine and Dr. Jim Strangenussen. They, in 92, and then the first paper published was 97, they did assume that if I spend long enough at altitude, I will have these erythropoietic responses. But in the same time, if I train a bit lower, I will have a better training quality. So the potential reduction in velocity that was assumed to be detrimental if you train high would be lower because you can maintain your running velocity since you train at a lower altitude. The first study was performed between Park City and Salt Lake City. So it was between 2,300-2,400 and 1,200-1,300. So we have to keep in mind that this study was not coming back to sea level. It was still training at moderate altitude, at a lower altitude than the altitude the athletes slept. And to be honest, this study, and I know Ben and I know Jim, obviously they've done a very good work. And this idea of combining the hypoxic dose by sleeping high and the better training quality by training low is very interesting. The point is that it has changed the way most of the athletes around the world now train in altitude. The living high, training low methods has been assumed to be the gold standard methods for very long. Personally, I'm not so sure that live high, train low is much better than live high, train high for endurance athletes. I think that the athlete should combine some phase where they play with only this hematological adaptation, live high, train high, and some phase where they need higher training quality, maybe just in the pre-competition period, where they can use more live high, train low. It's possible to do both. Also during the same training camp, you know, if you live in, if you stay in Font-Romeu, for example, you have the track at 1850, but you can also drive down to the valley and then you can train at 1000 meter. So you can do live high, train high for some period and then combine with live high, train low. What I do recommend now is to do live high, train low, and high. It is a method that is to combine live high, train low, and training high. And this method is very, very interesting since you can really combine, let's say, the classical methods, live high, train high, live high, train low, that are dedicated to the endurance athletes. You can combine that with a new training method that has been developed in my lab, and it is repeated spring training in hypoxia. And this repeated spring training in hypoxia is about doing very high intensity training as high as possible. And it is used now by cyclists, it is used by triathletes. So maybe you want to know more about this RSH, repeated spring training in hypoxia?
Absolutely. Yeah, let's talk a bit more about that.
You know, I was reading in one of the French cycling journal recently that Pogacar was mentioning that he was now using RSH. I know that the French cyclists, they used RSH. It is a method that has nothing to do with the erythropoietic responses. It is a method that will only improve your muscle ability to resist to fatigue, and especially to intermittent fatigue, you know, like repeated sprint. It is something we have developed in our lab that is also now used by the rugby player, football player, and so on and so on. So if I do a repeated sprint in hypoxia, I will have a very special mechanism that will occur. I will recruit fast twitch fibers because I'm sprinting, and the power output is very high. And in the same time, since it is in high altitude, I will induce a very large deoxygenation of the muscle. This deoxygenation will lead to a vasodilatory compensatory mechanisms. Because I have less oxygen in my capillary, and I need to provide the oxygen to the muscle at maximal intensity, my microcirculation will make possible to have this acute vasodilatory compensation mechanisms. And by itself, these mechanisms, meaning you have more blood coming to your muscles, that means more oxygen, more substrate, that could explain why you can sustain more sprint and or have a lower effect of fatigue during this intermittent maximal exercise. So guess now for a triathlete. If you are a triathlete, is the pacing even? For sure, in swimming, it's not the case. You have to reaccelerate every turn, you know, after the buoy, you have to reaccelerate. In cycling, it is not the case, especially over the short distance. It is a very erratic pace, attack, staying in the bunch, attacking, and so on. And even in running now, it is very important that you have this acceleration capacity. So this acceleration capacity, the fact that you can accelerate 1, 2, 3 times in a row, can be improved by RSH. And I would recommend your audience to find the publication about that. And then I come to the new training method, living high, training low, and high. You know, if yes. Sorry.
I'll put the link to your paper on RSH in the show notes so that the listeners will be able to find it easily.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. So it is a method. We published the first paper in 2013. I did have this idea when I was in Qatar between 2004 and 2008. But at that time, we didn't have the opportunity to run proper studies. And I had to wait to come back to Lausanne, where I am now at the University of Lausanne in Switzerland, to run these studies. And the first paper was published by one of my ex-PhD students, Raphael Feiss, in 2013. And it is of interest to see that now you have many sports and many teams who are performing this type of methods. In team sports, obviously, because repeated sprint ability is of interest in team sports, you know, if you are in racket sports, but also more and more combined with the classical methods in endurance sports, because there's no even pace in real world. You need the light, you know. I was watching Cheptegei a few days ago. You need the light to have an even pace. In the real world, during like a championship race, it is really an even. You have to accelerate, decelerate, and reaccelerate very often. And in triathlon, it's even more the case, with especially during the biking part. So you live high, you train low. That means you've got the erythropoietic benefits living high. You've got the quality of training low. And in the same times, two or three times a week, you stay high, and it can be done. Even the first week during the acclimatization phase, you do short sets of RSH, means 6 to 10 second sprinting sets, very short session, and you have to keep the quality. If you want to recruit the fast twitch fibers, you have to keep the quality during the training set.
What would the set look like? How many sprints and how long recoveries and how many sets?
So for the let's talk about short distance triathletes, like Olympic distance triathletes.
Yeah.
I would recommend it should be 3 to 4 sets of 4 to 6 sprint of 10 seconds with 15 to 20 seconds of recovery. You know, it's very short.
Yep.
You can do that on the turbo, on the bike. You can do that uphill in running, whatever. You know, you can do that in swimming if the swimming pool is high enough. And it doesn't affect the way that you will train. If you keep training at altitude, the aerobic session, I keep the recommendation below the first threshold. If you are Ironman, so obviously you can do more repeated sprint training combined to the low intensity training, but the justification is a bit lower, because on Ironman the need of resisting to acceleration is less obvious. Just some critical moment during the race, you would require this ability to accelerate.
Yeah. And one other thing that I would like to ask about is, for people that are living at altitudes year round, so people that are living in, for example, in Park City or in Boulder, Colorado, or other places where you have that the kind of altitude that we're talking about, how does that impact, does it impact how they should be training and adjust training potentially?
Yeah, of course, because they will. Because if they spend year-long, year-round in altitude, they will be acclimatized. But one of the risks is to have a quality of training that will be damaged. So I would recommend, even for these people, for them to do low altitude training camp. You know,
yeah,
it's more or less the way the East African runners are doing now. They spend most of their time during the preparation period in Eton. I was lucky to be in Eton, Kenya, when I was with Qatar. And but they have to come to low altitude for competition on a regular basis. And I think it's part of the reason they are so successful. They have this large base training in altitude, but also they can come to sea level to do more intense training. And I would not recommend, for example, to have permanent altitude training in altitude.
Yeah,
it would. I think at one point the benefits of that can be counterbalanced by I don't mean that it would be detrimental, but I mean that the benefits will be at the end very low.
Yeah. And if you are living at altitude and you have a sea level race that you're going to, should you also then keep in mind that those windows of opportunity, either race in the very first few days or stay at sea level for 12 plus days before you race, so that you don't have that window?
Yeah, that would be my recommendation, to do the tapering at a sea level. And then including in the tapering, obviously you have less high intensity session, but you can make short high-intensity session at sea level. That means if everything goes well, the power output can be quite high.
Yeah. And another topic, but perhaps the final one on altitude is, what's your opinion on altitude tents and chambers and masks and other stuff that we can use at sea level?
Yeah, it's a very important topic. We did conduct some study to compare hypobaric hypoxia, that's the real altitude. You know, hypobaric means decreased in barometric pressure, but for the same oxygen fraction, 20.93% of oxygen in the ambient air. That's the type of altitude you will have in the mountain. But most of the hypoxic tent, hypoxic chamber, it is based on normobaric hypoxia. Instead of changing the barometric pressure, you only change the oxygen concentration. That will lead to the same effect, a reduction in the oxygen pressure. So you can perfectly match hypobaric hypoxia and normobaric hypoxia. In one case, decreased in barometric pressure. In the other case, decreased in oxygen fraction. And one of the key questions is it exactly the same? Is it exactly the same to sleep in altitude or to sleep in a chamber? So we've been lucky with one of my friends who's a head physiologist of the French Nordic ski team, Laurent Schmidt. We did investigate in a crossover design some Spanish triathletes. The first year, half of the group slept in hypoxic chamber, and the second year they moved to real altitude to do live high train low, and vice versa, you know. So it was a crossover, and at the end we found that it's not exactly the same. You don't sleep exactly the same way, you don't breathe exactly the same way, but for performance related parameter, and again the most important one is total mass of hemoglobin, it was very close. We cannot say it is an advantage to do live high train low in real altitude, in, let's say, compared to simulated altitude. But for medical reason, we can also take into account that there is a specific effect of hypobaria. Above the hypoxic effect, the severity of altitude is always a bit higher in real altitude than in simulated altitude. That's why when you set the altitude in an hypoxic chamber, you have to set the oxygen pressure as if you wanted a higher altitude. You understand? So if you want to have your athletes to sleep at 2,700 in real altitude, then you find the location at 2,700. If you want to have them to sleep at 2,700 in an hypoxic chamber, and it is, for example, 14% of oxygen to be at 2,700, then you will set the oxygen fraction a bit lower, as if it would be 3,000.
Hmm.
The severity of altitude is higher in real compared to simulated altitude.
Hmm.
We believe that simulated altitude is really of interest for many reasons. You can much more easily adapt the hypoxic dose, the stress, athletes by athletes. You know, if you are in Boulder, it's difficult to move. If you are in an hypoxic facilities, you can have one room at 2,700 and one room at 2,200. It's much better to individualize the training. You have to take into account the differences. And now there's a vast body of literature showing that it is not exactly the same. But again, performance-wise, it's about the same benefits to use simulated versus high altitude. Real altitude.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting knowledge to hear that you can actually achieve the same performance benefits and perhaps with the advantage of being able to more easily individualize the altitude and adjust it according to the individual's needs. Very, very interesting. We have talked for quite a long time, and we did talk before the interview about a number of case studies that you have conducted with, among others, Kylian Jornet and Romain Bardet. But I don't think we have time to talk about all of them, unfortunately. I will link to your ResearchGate profile and people can find them. I do want to ask you about one very recent case study that you published, which was called 11 Years Monitoring of the World's Most Successful Male Biathlete of the Last Decade. So can you just give a brief overview of what this case study was about and discuss things like the training intensity distribution that you found and also your use of heart rate variability in or the monitoring with heart rate variability with this athlete?
Yes, first of all, we are very grateful to Martin Fourcade to let us use his training data. It is a study we did conduct with the head physiologist of the Nordic Ski, of the French Nordic Ski team, and with the coach of Martin. So, as you said, we had previous case study with Romain Bardet in cycling and Kylian Jornet in ski mountaineering and trail running. And it is of interest to understand that between these top athletes in different sports, many, many similarities in terms of training distribution, use of altitude, and so on and so on. So there are some basics now that are needed to perform at the world level. And one of the compulsory parameters is the use of altitude. You know, we've been involved in sometimes quite, passionate debate about the fact that altitude training could be or not be effective anymore for the athletes who have already, you know, very high VO2 max, very high HB mass value. We believe that even this top champion, they still can use altitude training to get this 2-4% improvement in VO2 max, hemoglobin mass, and then performance post-altitude. So the fact that Martin Fourcade let us use his training data is interesting because, as you said, we did monitor the training intensity distribution. I don't know if you did interview Stephen Saylor about polarized training already.
Yes, we have.
Yes, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. And we did observe some very strong relationship between the low training volume between the two thresholds in the heavy domain and the number of top three podium during World Cup events. You know, it means the most polarized Martin's training was, the most successful he was. And we used heart rate variability to monitor his adaptation. You know, I was talking about the use of heart rate variability during the altitude training camp. More and more elite athletes use heart rate variability year-long because it's a very easy, accurate, and non-invasive way to monitor the autonomous nervous system responses, the way you will adapt to the training load. I would recommend the athletes to use heart rate variability always, but especially during the critical period of the season. And one of the critical periods is obviously altitude training. But it's also very useful when you have jet lag. It's very useful when you are doing HIIT training, or it's very useful if you are starting to manipulate your diet. Every critical period that can lead to overreaching or that can lead to a large amount of fatigue and counterperformance, HRV is, in my view, a very interesting method. And for Martin, we had some very nice relationship between improvement in the parasympathetic related parameter of HRV, number of podium per year, and polarized training. Just to come back quickly to the case study we had on with Kylian Jornet. Kylian is a good example of someone who did practice live high, train low, and high. He was sleeping in an hypoxic tent. He was training. Most of the training was low, but he was also doing one session high using a mask system. So it is of interest to see that this top athletes are feeling what could be the best for them, and it's very close to our recommendations. That's why it was of interest for us also to have this case study about the preparation of Kilian before the Mount Everest record a few years ago.
Yeah, that is very interesting. And as I told you before the interview, but I'll tell the listeners now, I'm currently reading Kilian's autobiography, Above the Clouds, or his book, Above the Clouds, which includes the Everest record, and but also just his general upbringing and training throughout his life. And it's a fascinating book and that I would recommend to all the listeners. And as you say, very interesting to hear about his training and altitude adaptation. One follow-up about Martin and the case that you did with him. Was the HRV monitoring only monitoring, or did he actually use it so in to adapt training or adjust training? If the HRV was low, he maybe didn't do the intense training he had planned and so on.
Yeah, that's something that is used because the monitoring was done by Laurent, you know, who was the head physiologist. After that, I don't know exactly the extent that means. I don't know exactly if the training was really modified on a daily basis. Yeah. Because as you mentioned, there are now some way of prescribing training based on the morning HRV. We did a study that we called the guided HRV. Leave high train low. So we did modify the leave high train low training for 2 weeks just based on the HRV responses monitored in the morning. And in this study, we showed that leave high train low was more effective than if we didn't do that. So we had a control group with HRV, but the training was not modified. And we compare with this HRV guided leave high train low period. So that's why we believe that it is of interest to do that, especially because the risk of fatigue, the risk of overreaching are very, very high during this altitude training. You know, for the listener, I would like to really emphasize the fact that altitude training is not something that is neutral. It is an additional stress. It is something that can be effective. And if well monitored, it can be really effective. You can get this 3-4% performance enhancement. That is huge at the elite level. But at the same time, I have many, many examples of large counterperformance, poor performance post-altitude training, simply because it is easy that you don't manage this additional stress in a proper way. So
yeah,
it can be at the elite level, I go to altitude and I'll see. Now it doesn't work, because if you see, it's likely that you will be overtrained, overreach post-altitude.
That's good advice. So final question before the rapid fire questions. If you can give 3 pieces of advice to athletes and or coaches, you can choose, you can mix. What would those key pieces of advice be? And I want to hear just mention for the listeners that you also have a very extensive experience as a great triathlete yourself back in the day and a triathlon coach as well. So you're not just an academic that gives this advice, but with somebody with great applied knowledge as well.
Right. So my first advice will be to monitor your responses, hydration, heart rate variability, saturation in a very accurate way, especially during the first week, the first week of acclimatization. For me, it is a complete nonsense to go to altitude without a monitoring system in place. The second piece of advice is to monitor your post-altitude responses, just your feeling, you know. It can be using like a visual analogic scale of fatigue, your mood and so on, post-altitude, to determine what can be the best timing for performance post-altitude. If you are lucky and you get the full support of physiologists, it can be done in a, let's say, sophisticated way. But an athlete by himself can use his feeling or simply training data to identify what can be the optimal timing for the performance post-altitude. And my third advice is, again, that altitude training is not neutral. That means coaches and athletes, they have to educate themselves. You can't use altitude training just once before a competition. It has to be something that has to be integrated in the development of youth athletes. It has something that you have to replicate to improve how you behave, how you train, how you recover, and so on. And it is something then that can really be used very, very often, as long as you know exactly what to do.
And if you can give one piece of advice that is general, not just related to altitude, but anything within endurance sports, what would that be?
My advice would be polarized training and HRV.
All right. And finally, let's move on to the rapid fire questions. So take just one quick sentence to answer these. And the first one is, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to endurance sports?
I have two books that I really like. The one of Hutchinson, Endure, and the other one from Marcora, How Bad Do You Want It?
How Bad Do You Want It is from Matt Fitzgerald. But
No, it's about Matt Fitzgerald, sorry, but it's based also on some Marcora's theory.
Exactly. Yeah.
Sorry. You're completely right. And I like the way Hutchinson is writing about endurance. I think it's very often it's very relevant and interesting.
Yeah, I often refer to his articles, definitely. I agree with that. What's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
As an athlete or as an academic?
It's up to you. You can choose.
Okay. It's just hard work. I think to not be discouraged at the first failure. You know, success is just 1% inspiration and 99% perseverance.
Yeah. And finally, who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
I don't have any athletes that is like a hero for me. But I'm very impressed by Kilian Jornet. I'm impressed by his performance, obviously, you know, 92 of VO2 max. But I am also impressed by the way he's sharing his data and the way he's conducting his career. It is quite uncommon to have the freedom to do whatever you want as an elite athlete, you know, because you have to be on this competition. You cannot set your own competition. And he's still very young, but he was able to change his goal and to be successful in different sports, now in mountaineering. So he's a good... For me, it's a good example of somebody who can be a real elite athlete, but in the same time, to be an adventurer, to be, and I think that's, is it correct, adventurer?
Yeah, exactly. Yes,
and that's why I think he's inspiring so many people. Beyond the athletics performance, there is also the freedom that he can choose his goals and choose his life.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. His personality has inspired a lot of people, not so much from his performances, which are out of this world, really, and a lot of people probably can't relate to them, but just the way that he also isn't necessarily like taking them too seriously. For him, it's all about, at the end of the day, enjoying what he loves the most. And that's something that I think has inspired countless people and me as well. So definitely a good...
And just the last comment, I think the very exceptional athletes, you know, the guys who are number one, most of them are very curious. They are interested to understand what's going on for them. Okay, obviously they train hard, they compete hard, so they don't have time to really, let's say, publish, but they are reading, they are aware of what's going on. So, and science and sports science are really moving forward at a quick pace, but it's impressive how these guys can be in touch with the most recent stuff published in the field.
Mm. Yeah,
so be curious, work hard and be curious.
Yeah, great advice, absolutely great. So, Gregor, where can the listeners keep up with your updates when you have new research and stuff? Twitter, perhaps, ResearchGate, anything else you want to mention?
I think Twitter is the best way. ResearchGate, if you really want to go deep in the publication. But Twitter is a very nice way to be in touch with the sports science community and also to see the interaction between athletes and support staff and scientists. Twitter is good. So my Twitter is Grégoire Millet 1.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Grégoire. It was really great to have you on. And thank you so much for your generous use of time for this interview. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. And I will follow you on a regular basis now. Thank you.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview and learned a lot from it. I know that I certainly learned a lot of things that I was not aware of before about altitude training. So super fascinating to talk with Grégoire, and very generous of him to give so much time to the podcast. So very appreciative for that. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com with links to Grégoire's Twitter, ResearchGate, and university profile pages, as well as some of the key studies and papers that we've mentioned, so including, for example, the case study with Martin Fourcade and several of the other key papers or key topics that we discussed. I won't list them all here, but you can find them in the show notes or in the episode description. On Thursday, we'll have another Q&A, and then on Monday, we will have a training talk with Coach Sebastian Zeller from Germany, who was recommended as a guest by Coach Dan Lorang, who is the coach of Jan Frodeno and Anne Haug, of course, a past guest of the podcast. If you haven't listened to that, go and do so. I haven't yet conducted the interview with Sebastian, but that is a fantastic stamp of approval to be recommended by Dan. So that should be a fantastic interview. If you are searching for training plans or coaching services, now is a great time to do so, as we are kind of in the off season and building up towards 2021, where hopefully we'll have a bit more races than we had this year. So go and check out scientifictriathlon.com and what we have to offer there. And do send me an email if you have any questions or queries to michael@scientifictriathlon.com. And that's Michael with a K. Big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Go and take their free online sweat test to get a personalized hydration strategy and get 15% off your order with the promo code thattriathlonshow15. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses, and get 20% off your order with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart, and keep loving triathlon.